Welcome back to Coriem. I'm Brian Gabriel, and today we're joined by one of our brilliant senior residents and frequent contributor to Coriem, Dr. Sadaqat Chowdhury. Great to have you on, Sadaqat.
Great to be here, Brian. Thanks for having me.
So today we're going to talk about a very complex topic, acute respiratory distress syndrome. This is a pathology that has all the things that you don't want in an illness, potentially difficult to diagnose, challenging to treat, and is a malady that threatens the sickest of the sick. But before we embark on this discussion, Sadaqat, start us off with a case.
Of course, let's start with a case. So let's paint a picture. You're in the emergency department. It's 3 a.m. You've got a very classic presentation. You've got a 70-year-old coming in, history of ILD, who is coming in coughing, hacking away a lot of sputum. He has sick contacts at home who have influenza. He comes in and he looks pretty sick. He's febrile to 101. Blood pressures are okay, but he's really working to breathe. And his oxygen saturation is 65% on room air. So this is a very, very classic presentation of ARDS.
Okay, so judging just based on the vitals, this is a very sick patient. And the first step we take is trying to diagnose what ails our patient. So Sadaqat, can you outline the diagnostic criteria and then branch out into what specifically we would be looking for on exam, what might be useful in labs, and how we are using imaging to help clinch to the best of our ability the diagnosis of ARDS?
Of course. So ARDS is essentially non-cardiogenic pulmonary edema. And the diagnostic criteria that we typically use is the Berlin criteria, which has four major components to it. The first component is acute onset. It has to be within the last 7 days. The second one is diffuse bilateral infiltrates on chest x-ray, which is notoriously subjective. The third component is it shouldn't be due to heart failure. And the fourth component is that it has to have a P to F, the PaO2 to FiO2 ratio of less than 300. And we can get into the nitty-gritty of different severities of ARDS. Mild ARDS is P to F 200 to 300, moderate is 100 to 200, and severe is less than 100. One important thing in defining ARDS is when you are taking the P to F ratio, you typically have to get an ABG in order to be able to tell the PaO2. ARDS is very, very common, especially in ICU patients. It tends to happen in up to 23 to 25% of mechanically ventilated patients, and the mortality is very, very high. Mortality is usually because of multi-organ failure and tends to happen in 35 to 45%. So the imaging that we're getting for a lot of these patients down in the ED include point-of-care ultrasound, includes an x-ray, chest CT. As I said, it's fairly notoriously subjective on chest x-ray. But the reason it's subjective is because you want to be able to tell apart pulmonary edema due to a cardiogenic cause versus due to ARDS. And when we focus these patients in the ED, cardiogenic pulmonary edema tends to have B-lines throughout the entire lungs versus with ARDS, it's more patchy. And similar on chest CT, cardiogenic pulmonary edema tends to be diffuse with a lot of septal thickening and pleural effusions versus with ARDS, it tends to be more patchy with dense consolidations and otherwise normal lungs. With this gentleman that we described before, he has ILD, so he's not going to have great lungs at baseline.
Right, and this is an important point, that ARDS may not be the solitary diagnosis that afflicts these patients. But let's take a step back for a moment and delve into the pathophysiology as well as identify the patients at highest risk for developing ARDS. And this understanding will hopefully enable us more accurately to determine which individuals warrant particular attention for ARDS.
Yeah, the pathophysiology of ARDS exists in different phases. So the first phase, which is really the damaging phase, is the exudative phase, where you have a lot of immune-mediated alveolar damage, you have a lot of pulmonary edema, a lot of cytokine release. Then the proliferative phase is where you have reabsorption of that edema. The fibrotic phase is unfortunately why patients end up on mechanical ventilation for such a long time. When you have fibrosis of the lungs, you can prolong the ventilation. In terms of what causes ARDS, there's a lot of different causes for it. There's direct injury and there's indirect injury. The most common causes are typically infection, typically pneumonia, but other direct causes are toxins, aspiration, trauma, or drowning. And some indirect causes include pancreatitis, transfusions, drug side effects, and even DIC.
Perfect, Sadaka. And to circle back to the tests that we're getting, there's going to be a lot of overlap with our infectious workup, with a possible difference in imaging, meaning we're looking for B lines and ultrasound and considering a CT chest to get a better look at the lungs. And at this point, we likely have our diagnosis more or less pinned down, and we can start talking about management, which is intricate to say the least. A lot of times, we are starting some of these interventions as soon as the patient comes through the door, and we see the vital signs and general appearance of the patient. But let's go through the components of management one by one, Sadakat, starting with fluids.
Fluid management in ARDS is difficult. The FACT trial shows us that you want to maintain a conservative fluid balance, and you want to perform your fluid resuscitation in conjunction with looking at the patient's clinical status. So that means making sure to listen to the lungs, using POCUS in order to take a look at the size of the IVC, because these patients can get fluid overloaded very quickly. Some of these patients who are coming in floridly septic may require some fluids as well, but you want to maintain a net even strategy for the most part.
Okay, so be judicious with our fluids. And how about this timeless question of whether this patient would benefit from steroids? What is our understanding of the role of steroids in managing ARDS?
So steroids seem to be most beneficial in ARDS in disease processes that typically respond to steroids. So things like pneumonia, sepsis, ILD, pneumonitis, and they tend to be helpful very early on. There have been a couple of studies that have looked at methylprednisolone as well as dexamethasone. The DEXA-ARDS trial looked at dexamethasone specifically, and they looked at early initiation of steroids, meaning within the first 14 days.
Okay, so now we can move on to oxygenation, which is, as expected, the most complex part of the management for these patients. So let's outline how we are approaching this aspect of care and the recommendations as we escalate our interventions.
So when we talk about oxygenation in ARDS, we're really talking about non-invasive versus invasive oxygenation. So in the non-invasive camp, we have high-flow nasal cannula and we have BiPAP, both of which have been shown to reduce rates of intubation in ARDS. High-flow nasal cannula, specifically in the Florali trial, has been shown to be very helpful, especially in patients with pneumonia or a high sputum burden. And patients who can tolerate BiPAP, aka patients who are not aspiration risk, don't have huge sputum burdens, BiPAP has also been shown to reduce intubation risk, especially in the RECOVER-RS trial. And in the invasive camp, we have mechanical ventilation. And there's a couple of goals that we have with mechanical ventilation, including the oxygenation goal, the ventilation goal, tidal volume, PEEP, and the plateau pressure goal. So in the oxygenation goal, we want to maintain oxygenation with a SAT of 88 to 95%, meaning a PaO2 of 55 to 80 on your ABG. We want to avoid hyperoxia in these patients, and you can titrate your FiO2 as well as PEEP to match this oxygenation goal. The ARDSnet trial, huge trial looking at mechanically ventilated ARDS patient, has a great table on how to titrate the PEEP with the FiO2 to maintain that oxygenation that we'll put in the show notes. In terms of your ventilation goal, it's okay to be a little bit hypercapnic as long as the pH remains above 7.2. The problem with hypercapnia in patients who aren't mechanically ventilated is they start to get very somnolent with high PCO2s, but with patients who are mechanically ventilated, it's okay to maintain a permissive hypercapnia with these patients. Just making sure to not allow this permissive hypercapnia with specific patient populations, including those who have RV failure or elevated ICPs. In terms of your tidal volume goal, a lower tidal volume, so 6 cc's per kilogram of ideal body weight, and I highlight ideal body weight here, meaning depends on the patient's height and gender. A lower tidal volume of 6 cc per kg has been shown to be more beneficial versus a higher tidal volume of 12 cc in the ARDSnet trial. And this is something that we call lung protective ventilation. So the reason that we try to maintain a low tidal volume is to avoid barotrauma, because barotrauma can lead to a lot of issues in these patients who are mechanically ventilated for a long period of time. And some surrogates that we use for patients who are mechanically ventilated are the plateau pressure and the driving pressure, which are surrogates for transpulmonary pressure. So the driving pressure is the plateau pressure minus the PEEP, which we want to maintain at less than 15. And the plateau pressure, which we can calculate with an inspiratory hold on a ventilator, we want to maintain less than 30, again, in order to prevent barotrauma in these prolonged mechanically ventilated patients.
Okay, Sadakat, so far, I think it'd be fair to say with respect to management, we don't want to overdo it, but we also don't want to underdo it. So avoid hyperoxia. Don't flood with fluids. High flow nasal cannula may get them through the pulmonary insult without having to intubate. Low tidal volume ventilation, and try to keep PEEP low. Now, how about when these measures aren't enough? What then?
So when these measures aren't enough, then there are some other things that we can do. And this may happen in the ICU versus the ED, depending on how long patients are boarding. But these patients tend to get dyssynchronous with the vent very, very quickly. They may have flow hunger, not get adequate tidal volumes, maybe breath stacking, whatever the case. We want to make sure that these patients are not dyssynchronous with the vent, so we want to sedate them effectively, and we want to maintain a RASS goal of -2, -3, even down to -4. There are salvage modes of ventilation, including APRV for refractory hypoxemia. Just being careful not to initiate APRV on patients who have COPD or asthma just because of the increased I to E time. But good optimized ventilation and sedation is key in these patients. And when that doesn't work, then you can move on to paralysis. Paralysis has been shown to be effective in early ARDS when within 48 hours, but if you paralyze someone, just be careful to make sure that they're adequately sedated before paralyzing. If paralysis doesn't work, then the next thing that you can try is proning, and the reason that proning may work is because our posterior lung tissue becomes de-recruited early on in the disease. Because patients are supine all the time, there's a lot of gravity-dependent fluid, and typically the amount of lung tissue is greater posteriorly than it is anteriorly. So proning helps ventilate and recruit this lung tissue a lot more. But remember, you should not prone someone until you have optimized them on the vent for at least 12 to 24 hours, meaning making sure to adequately sedate them, paralyzing them if necessary, and only then should you consider proning. If proning doesn't work, there's also inhaled pulmonary vasodilators. There isn't a lot of data on this. And by inhaled pulmonary vasodilators, I'm talking specifically about inhaled nitric oxide and epoprostenol, which may not be available in all hospitals or emergency departments. There hasn't been a lot of trials on this, but it can be effective in refractory hypoxemia and ARDS. If all of this doesn't work, then really the only thing that you're left with is VV ECMO. Not all centers are VV ECMO equipped. So if you have a really, really sick ARDS patient who's refractory to all this management, make sure you think about transfer early.
Perfect, Sadakat. A very complex topic. And in these scenarios, we won't have the time to review all these finer points on management. So it's great that we go over it in this episode. Now let's move on to some take-home points. It is critical that we keep ARDS in mind when we evaluate patients who are gravely ill. This can be difficult to diagnose, but one tool that is used is the Berlin criteria. But also understand that this may not be a solitary diagnosis. The patient may have multiple pathologies leading to their presentation. One of the difficulties in evaluation of these patients can be distinguishing cardiogenic pulmonary edema from ARDS on imaging, such as CT and bedside ultrasound. And also keep in mind that these patients may have both. Be judicious with fluids and know that some patients may benefit from a conservative approach here. Consider steroids if it has a role in treating the underlying pathology, and don't forget prompt antibiotics if infection is suspected. We must be very deliberate in our approach to oxygenation and ventilation. Try to avoid hyperoxia. Attempt to achieve lung protective ventilation with low tidal volumes, and refer to the ARDSnet table as you adjust PEEP and FiO2 in your intubated patients. Finally, these interventions may not be enough to save the sickest of our sick patients. And know that, as Dr. Chowdhury discussed, there are measures beyond these that we should consider in concert with our critical care team. Okay, that'll do it for this episode. Sadakat, thanks so much for joining us and reviewing this essential topic.
No problem, Brian. Thanks for having me.